push that.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody, so much for joining today. I think we're expecting a few more people in person, but want to be cognizant of time, especially since we have some external speakers, which I'm really excited about. So wanted to just go ahead and get us kicked off. Let's do a quick roll call. First, let's do in person. We're going to go down the list and just verify that you're here. And this is helpful for the folks on the phone just to know who's here in the room. And then we'll go, if the folks on the phone hear their names, please go ahead and just verify your attendance. So, Christian, are you here by chance? Okay. And this is Chris Botts, board chair. Excited for you all to be here. So next up is Mary. Mary, are you present?
Yes.
Excellent. Dr. Chapman, are you on the phone? All right. Kelly Cronin, are you joined us by phone? Okay. Dr. Jope, are you on?
Yes, I'm here.
Perfect. Thanks so much for joining us today. Dr. Freeman, are you on the phone?
No.
All right. It sounds like maybe a few more people are joining via elevator. Dr. Henninger, are you on?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. Dr. Jacobs? All right. Dr. Nesbitt? Justin Palmer?
Here.
Donna?
Here.
And Dr. Royster?
Here.
Allison, Rain?
Present.
Claudia is not with us yet. Brian Sivak, are you on the phone? All right. Dr. Sorrell? Pete Stossel? Sakita, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. James Turner? All right. Archana? And Bill Ward sent me an email. Unfortunately, he had an emergency situation, so he might try to join us late, but he's probably not going to be able to join us today. And then Dr. Nesbitt made it through the security line, so thank you for joining us today. So, and then we have also a guest from us today, Megan Vandersol. She's joining us from the Department of Health and Human Services from the state of Michigan. I'm really excited to have her joining us today. She'll be leading us through a presentation on their HIV environment within Michigan, as well as how that's working with some of their data warehousing efforts. So appreciate you joining us today for that. So based on those that have stated they are here, we're at 11 folks for quorum, which means that we do not currently have quorum for the meeting today, which is too bad. I know it's hard sometimes to make these meetings, but it's really critical for us to be able to get that quorum so we can actually formally vote on initiatives. So we'll have to maybe follow up either via phone call or email to see if there's anything we can do between now and the November meeting. And with that, just to give a quick overview of the agenda for today. So first off, we have, and I'm sure Dr. Jope, this is going to make you happy. I know this is something you've mentioned a few times. But we have a WebEx today. It was necessary in order to be able to have a presentation from Michigan, but it's also something we're trying out to potentially see whether it works for these meetings moving forward. I will say that I am a little fearful that with the use of WebEx that the in-person attendance will go down, and it's really critical for us to be able to have as many people as possible join us in person. I feel very strongly that the conversations are a lot more dynamic when folks are interacting face-to-face. So if, for whatever reason, we start doing WebEx and the in-person meeting attendance drops dramatically, I am going to remove that as an option from us to make sure that people are really working with the confines of the meeting and really making this a priority in their schedule to be here in person as much as possible. So just a quick overview of today. Like I mentioned, we're going to have a presentation by Michigan. Really excited to bring in some outside experience with what's going on in their environment and how we might be able to apply some of their principles or approaches to the environment here in the district. We're also going to have a brief presentation from our data warehousing team. We have a data warehousing effort that's been underway for a few years. They have a launch, a soft launch internally for us at the end of this month, and have a larger launch next September at the end of FY17. So wanted to be able to provide you all some knowledge about what's going on with that initiative and how that might be able to influence some of the discussions that we're going to be talking about today. So with that, why don't we, because I know Megan has a hard stop at 3 and we're a little behind, so I'm going to skip the meeting minutes and come back to that after 3 so we can go ahead and get to Megan's presentation. So I'm going to try, Megan, to give the presenter capabilities to you, and hopefully it works. IT, especially in IT meetings, sometimes likes to make things a little bit more difficult, so hopefully this works out. So you should, Megan, you should get a message that you've got the presentation right, and hopefully you should be able to drive from here.
Sure, let's just double check. I don't know if I am.
try...
go to quick start and then do share screen. Quick start is the upper left hand corner of the WebEx.
So, no, that's so the screen that you're on already, Megan, should be what you can use, or you can use the screen that you're using now.
Yeah.
As long as it works, that's all really matters in my mind.
Tell me to
what?
Yes, that would be great.
So the good news is I serve as a Michigan HIT coordinator, but yet I don't know how to run my own screen.
So it looked like you moved it. I don't think I did it, but if you go to...
You want to just move the slides for me? That might work just as well.
Let's do it.
Okay. I'll just tell you when. Perfect. So, for introductions, my name is Megan Vandersalt. I serve as the policy director here within the policy division at Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. I'm also Kim Batchelder, also of my area, and serves as our technology lead within the policy division to be part of the conversation, too. Both Kim and I have been involved in this health information exchange and statewide data sharing efforts for quite a number of years. In fact, prior to us being part of the policy division, we served as the health information technology office that administered and oversaw the grants that really helped stand up our statewide infrastructure for health information exchange. And so today we wanted to offer a little bit of information about the history behind that, where we're at today, and where we see that going further, because it is quite an evolution that I'd say spans a good 10 years, and with probably a lot more to come, too. So one of the things that I think are really important to emphasize is the strategy that was behind our Michigan approach to HIE. And like I noted, this really started some time ago, about 10 years. Actually, wow, it was a minute or so ago, in which our then-Governor Granholm really saw the need and understood the value that health information exchange presented, and called upon a group of stakeholders to work on a white paper that became known as our Conduit for Care. And it really set the stage as a blueprint for what we saw were the guiding principles for Michigan's strategy for HIE. And those are outlined on the screen. We really wanted to employ a public-private model versus having complete state control over what would become the HIE infrastructure. We saw this as kind of a new type of entity, one that had close ties with us in state government, but really was outside of us in terms of an organizational structure. We wanted one that emphasized a common data sharing use cases and multi-stakeholder participation. We knew this wasn't just physician groups. This really wasn't just a hospital question. This wasn't a health plan or payer one. And it certainly wasn't just us here in state government as well. We, of course, wanted to promote the use of national standards and public transparency, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what that looks like here in Michigan. It's one of our advisory, overseeing advisory groups that we know as the HIT Commission. We saw the immediate value of leveraging our public health systems and public health messaging requirements as kind of the first step towards that. And keep in mind, this was initially in a time before meaningful use was even quite a thing, but it just happened that as we were progressing down this path, meaningful use and the era high-tech pieces came into play and actually really even further propelled our efforts beyond that, too. So it was a nice intersection point at that time. We also wanted to establish a designated nonprofit entity to interconnect a network of networks approach, and that's where we get into what became the Michigan Health Information Network of Shared Services, and we'll go into detail about what that means. Part of our history is that Michigan already had a number of health information exchange entities already in existence. So our real question became, how do we organize these and expand upon this kind of ecosystem in a way that is supportive of a trust framework and a larger governance piece that's in partnership with us as a state and others, as mentioned in bullet point two. And that's where our Michigan Health Information Network plays a big part of that. And lastly, relies on this idea of a qualified health information organization, and that really is reliant on what we'll discuss in a bit more detail on our governance structure and trust framework. Let me just stop there by saying if there's any questions along the way, please feel free to interrupt us and chime in. We are happy to answer questions at any point or at the end. Okay, next slide. So, we saw there was an opportunity to, there's kind of a couple of different approaches we could have taken for statewide coordination. Often, you kind of think of it as a one-to-one point of connection, which then creates a multitude of different connections that needs to be maintained and create a lot of complexities with that, and that's kind of what you see on the left side of the screen. Or we wanted to kind of, or another approach which we opted for, which is our shared services approach, where you have kind of a centralized place for connections and kind of a hub and spoke model, which is what we've opted for on the right hand side. Next slide, please. So where does this entity known as the Michigan Health Information Network come into play? That really is our backbone structure, or our main point in that hub and spoke model, and that is a network for sharing health information statewide for Michigan. So let me clarify that a bit. MyHIN is not a health information exchange entity. It is a network that helps support and facilitate data sharing across the state by being inclusive of organizations like health information exchanges, in addition to participating groups that we know as qualified organizations, which could be hospitals, payer groups, any multitude of folks that want to participate in this data sharing network of activities. Next slide, please.
Absolutely. And Megan, let me just stop you right there real quick. For those that are joining by phone or WebEx, can you hear Megan okay? I want to make sure that everybody, the phone's working well.
Yep.
Okay. Excellent. Continue. Sorry about that, Megan.
No, no problem. Thank you. So a little bit about the MyHIN governance structure. It is an independent, not-for-profit entity with a board of directors. Two of those board of directors happen to be representatives of our department here at the within Health and Human Services. One represents Medicaid area, since there are strong ties with a lot of our programming in that sense, in addition with our public health area, since that was one of our first areas where we were, did work related to messaging. As noted, the MyHIN Shared Services Network works very closely with us at the department, although they are not a state entity within the state governance. They, again, they're a nonprofit outside of it, but there's almost a little, there's a dotted line there. The MyHIN group has an operational advisory committee. That addresses the day-to-day activities and operations of HIE cleaning, privacy, and security items. So this is the MOAC, as we call it, or the MyHIN Operational Advisory Committee, is really the work groups that get a lot of the inner workings in the weeds kind of problems and issues worked out and it's been addressed. Next slide, please. Actually, I think we were missing a couple of my slides that I accidentally hid. That's okay, I can talk through it. So, yeah, I made that error, I think, before we sent that. Slide 6 and 7.
If you give me...
If you have it up on your screen, you can share your screen and we can see it. Megan, do you have it up on your screen?
I can. Can you... There we go, if you want to share my screen. Okay, I can walk through it. So, the statewide HIE governance model, I noted there's a role of our Health Information Technology Commission. It is a governor-appointed commission with representatives across the healthcare spectrum to serve in an advisory capacity and overseeing the strategy that I outlined over the last 10 years. They were formed in 2006 and still are very active as of today, too. And they've really been kind of the overseers and internal leads that laid out this strategy for information exchange and serve in a lot of ways a transparency vehicle for a lot of the different ideas and efforts that come into play. I'd also note, since a lot of the activities that we have underway are currently in production, so we are actively moving our different messages across the state on a day-to-day basis. So our activities and oversight, particularly from the HIT Commission perspective, have become less about the what to build and more about how do we use it. So I'd say within the last 2 to 3 years, strong pivot towards a more policy-driven advisory approach versus oversight of what kind of infrastructure was built. And so there's kind of a dotted line relationship between us and the department. We help support the HIT Commission, which serves as an overseeing group, and then the Michigan Health Information Network that's really charged with doing the work and providing the infrastructure to enable data sharing across the state. And so if you go to the next slide, This gives you an idea of what the Michigan Health Information Network statewide shared services model or ecosystem, as we like to call it, looks like today. So that cloud in the center serves as kind of representative of the entity itself, and then around the cloud as the multitude of different qualified organizations that are part of the network and participate in a variety of different what we call use cases for data exchange. To the right-hand side, you'll see our department represented. And in many ways, our department has what we all kind of looks and feels very much like our own HIE. It serves as the single point of entry for a lot of our state systems. For example, our immunization registry, our Michigan Syndromic Surveillance System, among other different things as well, too. And so MyHIN serves as the plumbing of sorts between us and other statewide entities for data exchange in and out of the state, as well as around the state, too. I'm going to pause there just for a moment to see if there's any questions.
I have a question that's probably very technical in nature.
Do you want to introduce yourself before Megan knows who you are?
So I'm LaQuan Genez, but I'm the director of our Department of Health here. So you said MindHand serves as the platform for all of this data to exchange, but is it a single platform, a single engine, a single technological solution for which all of this data exchanges? So, for example, down at the bottom, where all of the pharmacies are represented, do they pass through the same type of search engine or the same type of agnostic platform that MindHand hosts as your hospital systems or your immunization registry? Or is MindHand multiple solutions that then translates all of that data into something else?
That's a great question. So I'll go back to kind of a Michigan overlying principle. We've been pretty vendor agnostic in terms of what types of platform and or systems that are requirements, but have been very standards driven. I'm going to kick it to Kim to kind of talk more about how MindHand fits into that picture.
Hi, this is Kim Batchelder. And to help at a high level answer your question, So MindHand, like Megan said, is a statewide facilitator. So, for instance, you know, we have had their main responsibility is standardization of messages. So whatever platform you're using technology-wise, you know, especially when you're talking about, like, your Walgreens and CVS and those pharmacies, they require you to send a specific message in a standard format with standard data elements. And so that's how we're getting our pharmacy data into MindHand. And MindHand actually has a Rhapsody engine in which then they can translate that if it needs to be sent to some, like, in a different format to the state or wherever.
Okay.
So the whole principle behind MindHand is the fact of is facilitating the organizations around its infrastructure on a standard message with standard data elements so that it can be more interoperable with that vendor-agnostic theory that we have. Does that help answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah, although this is Kelly Cronin. I'm wondering, too, if you might be able to explain how some of the shared services are, in fact, centralized. So things like when you catch a QRDA and then you share it with Medicaid or the payers, that's something that can be served. That's like a one-stop shopping service for many parties in the state. So I think it might be helpful to understand that there are some things that are offered by MindHand that beyond sort of a governance layer of common standards.
So we have these, they're baseline use cases, they're infrastructure use cases that people need to participate in order to really get to that level, Kelly, that you're talking about of being able to send and receive is the important part, the data. So we have what's called the ACRES, or Access Care Relationship Statewide Service. We have a Health Provider Directory Service. And then we have it's coming on board right now, but it's called the Clinical Quality, Common Key Use Case. With those three use cases, you know, obviously at a high level, in order to become interoperable, you need to be able to share data to the right person at the right time, at the right point of care. With Access Care Relationship Service, that is a service that these organizations report active care relationships between the provider and the patient. So we're able to store in a health provider directory provider information, and then within our active care, up-to-date provider information, electronic service information, and then other demographic information for that provider on where they want that message sent, what EHR they're using. If they're serving at multiple locations, then what location should be sent, or should it be sent to all locations? And then the Access Care Relationship Service complements the health provider directory by linking those providers with attributed patients. So if there's a message that goes through the infrastructure, then the message bumps up against the Access Care Relationship Service and the health provider directory saying, this message is for patient X, and patient X is related to Dr. Z. So therefore, that message should go to Dr. Z at location 1, 2, and 3, if that makes any sense. So those are three baseline use cases that we are in the process of implementing through the Michigan Health Information Network, so that we can actually start beginning the query functionality. And then also right now, we have I don't know how many millions of ADT messages going right now, and in order to send that ADT message, it's very important for the Access Care Relationship Service to be in place.
This is Kelly again, that they have, it's so valuable to have that service she's talking about, to be able to, whether you want to know what the care team is.
It's hard to hear you, Kelly.
Yeah, we're having a hard time hearing
you. I'm sorry. I was just complimenting you all to say that Active Care Relationship Service is so valuable to have if you want to leverage that your technology, your shared services for things like attribution. So if you want for quality measurement to be able to keep a whole care team accountable for an outcome, or you want to route even the ADT message to the right, activated member of the care team who can actually receive it and act on it to prevent a hospitalization, it's really valuable for many different use cases, but particularly for measurement and for accurate exchange.
Thank you. Yeah, we absolutely agree. In fact, as we're getting further into the presentation, we wanted to talk just a bit about how some of these foundational use cases are really kind of the fundamental enabling pieces of some of our larger initiative and programmatic goals, too, and how we're intertwining our Mayhem partnership and some of our statewide data sharing efforts are really an intricate part of our programmatic goals, in as much as some of the larger outcomes we're trying to achieve, too. But in order to achieve that, I want to emphasize, and leads me to the next slide.
This is Victor Freeman. I'm one of the physicians on the board. I wonder if I could just ask a quick question.
Sure.
As I've learned more about health information technology, I have learned that everyone assumes that everyone shares the same definitions and puts the same information into all fields. And I've learned that simply isn't true. So even for something as simple as an ADT feed, what have you done to see how different facilities use those ADT feeds and feed information in to see what variability there might be in the quality of information coming in?
Absolutely. I don't know if we have a comparison at this point in time. Our first effort in the last, well, like I said, we've been on a 10-year journey thus far, and I'd say the first 5 years was really kind of establishing our state principles of what planning in terms of what this was meant to look and feel like. And then Mayhem was formally incorporated as a nonprofit in 2010 or 2011. My math's getting fuzzy. And then the bulk of the efforts during those first few years was really focused on creating a legal and trust framework that would help support data sharing in a big space. So less about the technology of the movement of the data and more about what are the rules of the road and the standardization that would be necessary in which to achieve that. And we certainly have that well established, and now the next layer is adding on to beyond just how many of the ADTs are moving around and a better understanding what are their uses of them and how can that be built upon. And that's just one example in the ADT space.
Thank you. I just think Chris has a lot of experience that.
Absolutely. Alright. Any more questions?
Chris, the current.
Alright. Megan, next slide.
Yes, please. So the next slide, one more. The next slide starts to talk a little bit more about what is meant by some of the legal infrastructure that we've found to be really a founding force in terms of stability of this model and how this moves this proposal forward. So the MyMIN structure is built upon an organizational agreement that includes one master use case agreement, one large data sharing agreement among each of the qualified organizations that is kind of the main entrance into the club, so to speak. And then each organization then has the opportunity to participate on a use case by use case basis once they have agreed to this master use case agreement. So this allows the flexibility for organizations to come in and participate in one, two, or many use cases, but the master agreement kind of states these are the rules in which you will follow and these are the things in which everybody must agree to and to participate across the board. Next slide. So what do we mean by a use case? MyMIN uses the term use case factory, but a use case is a specific data sharing scenario with a purpose and a type in which the type of data is exchanged and there's descriptions and interactions between people and or systems. And we have such a variety of use cases and we're continually getting ideas for new ones. They could be different based on access restrictions, rules and for the use of the data, cost recovery fees or charges or technical requirements associated with that. And we're easily finding that once you create one use case, others could be spawned off that one idea once you get it rolling. And then it really kind of, the use case factory idea allows for greater innovation as it continues. So the next slide, it gives you a sense of how that kind of works. So the use case factory starts with the kind of the concept in mind in which we define the purpose and we evaluate what is the potential with this one particular use case. Then it kind of goes into, it needs to look for a sponsor to see what's the value add that this use case provides. Then it potentially goes into a design and development phase that is kind of twofold. There's technical planning, and then there's some pilot and refinement that happens. The MyMIN board, and as I noted, we have two spots on that from the department side, along with representation from folks all across the healthcare spectrum in Michigan as well. So it goes on to approve and see if this use case is something that they want to proceed with. And then it goes into implementation. Assuming the successful adoption by folks across the network, which I believe we consider success at about 68% adoption rate. And then we consider it going into more of a mature status at that point where we consider it going into a critical mass. And then it goes into more of a maintenance operations and continuous improvement. For the ADT example, that's a perfect example of something that went through this entire use case factory process, and it's something that has been well adopted, well above and beyond, and it's now in full production. And the real big policy driver, I have to give credit to our partners over at Blue Cross, as they saw the value in this use case early on and actually wrote it into their requirements and associated incentive funding with it for its adoption, and it was really remarkable what happens when you throw incentive money towards something adoption like that, so much so that we saw quite an increase in ADT messaging as soon as those incentive programs were instated.
So, Megan, question, for this process, as you're going through the various different steps, how do you determine the potential funding mechanisms or fee structure associated with those use cases? Can you talk a little bit about how that's incorporated into the process?
The funding structure, I'm having a hard time hearing whoever you're speaking.
This is Chris. The funding mechanism, so it's fine to create an idea of a use case, but need to actually figure out how to fund it. So there's multiple different funding streams that you can utilize. I'm just curious where that comes into this process, and maybe talk a little bit about how that ends up end to end.
So a variety of folks could sponsor a use case. In some cases, as noted in the Blue Cross example, it was Blue Cross a payer that saw the value added for one particular piece or another. In some cases, it's been from our Medicaid programs specific to their Medicaid population needs, and it's kind of a driving force with that. And what's interesting, though, is the more this has gone on, we have found that the same use cases are of value across different fronts and across different programs. And
particularly because another one of mine is role that I haven't really hit on in a big sense was from inception, we really looked at the network as providing a convening role across different entities, across different payers, across different clinical organizations, across even, you know, between state and private partnerships. The idea being that from this kind of outside entity convening role, they are able to draw together folks and better understand what's the value add of a particular project and how can different groups utilize this in a standardized way that's a benefit for many, despite what for different payers or despite for different provider organizations. And ADTs are another example like that. I think our ACRES attribution model is another great example of that continues to come up.
And for the Medicaid side, when you all, if the Medicaid office is the sponsor, you all are using the MMIS 75-25 match, right, rather than the IAPD 90-10, or sorry, the high-tech 90-10?
In some cases, yes, we have used the high-tech 90-10. The advanced planning document process has been part of the some of our activity funding along the way.
This is Kim. A lot of the initial use cases that MyHinge started, for instance, were related to the Medicaid EHR incentive program, which was covered under the 90-10 funding. So, for instance, immunization reporting to the state, electronic lab reporting, and then syndromic surveillance system or syndromic surveillance messaging. Those were covered a lot under the 90-10 because that was associated with Medicaid EHR incentive. And, of course, any use case that is sponsored by Medicaid using the 90-10, you know, we're very specific on the fact that it's for the Medicaid beneficiaries.
Right. And how do you tackle the sustainability part of that since that's just design, development, implementation funds? How do you incorporate that in part of the plan for those use cases sponsored by Medicaid?
You're asking how do we continue to sustain it beyond just Medicaid funding for those activities?
In terms of the sponsorship, if you're using the 90-10, that's DDI funds, so that's meant to implement, but how do you incorporate or develop a plan for sustaining those use cases beyond the IAPD window that runs through 2021?
The kind of that critical mass piece comes in terms of adoption and seeing if there's value that then it becomes kind of both. A larger question of utilizing it and for what means and how it's sustained thereafter. But
so basically with the 90-10 fund, it's infrastructure built. So once we actually, you know, during the initial infrastructure build and onboarding process, we utilize the 90-10. Once it gets to that critical mass, then it goes into the operation, the maintenance and operations bucket in which when we have the 50-50, in which the state then has to come up with the general fund money to support that.
So in terms of, this is LaQuanja Nesbitt again, so in terms of the support for the overall MyHinge, is it just state supported or, because you mentioned that it was a non-profit, that's not a state government run entity, what are the resources or the revenue, where does the revenue come from to support the initiative? Because you have baseline operational cost separate from how the governing board determines what new components are built out. So as you're using your use case factory to determine what gets added, what shared services will be developed or enhanced to bring in new members or to continue to provide valuable services to existing members, there are baseline operational costs. So even when there's an IEPD that's used or the ONC funds that are used, whether it was brought in on the 90-10 or the 70-30, there's the ongoing 50-50 responsibility. So is that 50 always state government funding, or is it revenue generated by transaction fees? Like, what's the funding source for it from a sustainability perspective?
Sure. So we first utilized the ONC's HIE cooperative agreement to help stand up the organization itself as part of that grant funding opportunity. But there was always a long-term strategy, and going back to the way this was envisioned, that this was a nonprofit entity that needed to be sustainable on itself, which is certainly the case, although they are sustained by a number of different sources, including commercial payers, also transaction fees, as well as providing services to other states as well, too. So while some of the funding certainly is state-supported by some of our sponsorship of specific activities, from, for example, Medicaid dollars, a lot of their work is also supported by other entities well outside of the state as well, too. And that was in keeping with our model, where we charged them with looking for other revenue sources for sustainability long-term.
And I might also add the fact that MyHIN's philosophy behind their sustainability plan and their revenue is the fact that the plans will help support this. The health plans will help pay for this. So there's really no charge for provider organizations to connect. It's the health plans that kind of pick up the bill a little bit on this aspect by being a qualified organization in this infrastructure. There's a yearly fee to be a member for a health plan.
So if we go to the next slide, there's an overview of some of the statewide use cases and where they are in terms of production status and or, you know, if they're more of an conceptual basis or somewhere kind of in between. So it gives you a sense of where we're at with some of those things and where we might be going in addition to that. So if you notice that what we consider mature production, we currently have ADTs in that bucket, as well as immunization recording and syndromic surveillance. And the bottom two were actually our first use cases that went into the pilot and development at the beginning of the formation of MyHIN. So it's not surprising to see them more on the mature production. ADTs, again, as noted, were really propelled further by payers taking a champion role and driving those forward, and I only foresee more of that. And then we have quite a lot of things on the docket for that are nearing the mature production stage here very shortly. Some including what Kim noted with the active care relationship, health provider directory being kind of the top ones, and I fully anticipate some of those driving into the mature production here in the next year or two as some of our large initiatives really kind of push those forward. So next slide, please. So that kind of leads me into how we have tried to look at health information exchange as an enabler for our larger policy goals, and as such, we wanted to ensure that we're fully maximizing some of the policy levers at our disposal to kind of push these use cases and other data sharing efforts to full capacity. So one avenue in which we took this into account, Michigan is a large Medicaid managed care state. About 70% or so of our Medicaid population is within a HMO. And we have contract cycles, and recently we just underwent one of those, and with the new contract requirements, we wrote in that HIE efforts and specific use case activities were required and or needed to be encouraged as a health plan onto their providers in either of those scenarios. So that's been a big push. Our health plans are now having to actively participate in a number of those activities. In addition, some of our other programs are also looking to that same sort of thing. We also have what are called our prepaid inpatient health plans. This is the behavioral health equivalent of the health plan. Same idea. We wrote that into their contract that we wanted them to be fully engaged in the network and in statewide data sharing and look to them to participate in a number of use cases. And then lastly, we're currently a state innovation model participant. We'll be rolling into our implementation right now. where Kim and I are kind of funding it right now as we say that the next couple months are going to be extremely busy with those efforts. And in keeping consistent with where we're going with our contract requirements for our health plans are obviously very much part of our state innovation model, as well as private payers like Blue Cross. Well, this is an excellent opportunity to remain consistent across all these different fronts and further kind of throw our arms around the use of use cases as driving towards statewide standardization and really being enabling efforts into things like greater care coordination, greater quality metric alignment, and the list goes on and on. And FIN is all about all of those things. But to get there, we're booked towards our HIE efforts and our partnership with MyHint as a key component of all of the above. So the next slide, I think, is my last one, where we wanted to highlight a little bit about in particular, where some of those model objectives for state innovation model are really focused around performance metrics and reporting. This gets after the fact that trying to align some of our quality metrics into the same point. We're looking towards the HIE to help us with that. We wanted to create a stronger care coordination platform to facilitate access to information across different points of care. The way in which to do that is to be able to do an active care relationship across different provider types. And when I say provider, I mean that ideally in the broadest sense of the word, whether it's clinician, non-clinician, therapist, community worker, that's where the vision is of what we have going forward. Which then bumps up against where we want to go with population health and our efforts along with that within the state innovation model. It's with a strong emphasis on partnering with community-based groups that are kind of traditionally outside of the healthcare space but can provide huge support in bettering the health of a variety of different groups. And all of this hinges back onto our reliance on what we call the relationship attribution management platform, which is the way in which the how do we get folks attributed to better understand the connection points across the healthcare spectrum and other community groups and understand and measure and utilize better care coordination across those fronts. And state innovation model is just another opportunity to leverage what we've been building for the last 10 years and further test its value, which I fully anticipate is going to be a big piece of our goals and beyond, really. So with that, I know we've covered a ton, and I'm probably over, so I apologize. But we're happy to answer any questions.
Well, thanks again, Megan and Kim, for what I hope was a very enlightening presentation. You know, I really wanted to be able to have the board see what some of the concepts that we had been talking about over the last few board meetings. So we had talked about the idea of creating a strong foundation of rules of the road within the district. We've also talked about being very use case driven in terms of our approach to some of the initiatives. And I just wanted to show an environment where they have taken some of those large principles and applied them and been fairly successful. Obviously, they haven't met their ultimate goals, but that's kind of a moving target. But I've really been able to create an environment where other payers and other folks have been engaged in using that infrastructure to better improve the care within that jurisdiction. So I thank you all again for letting us know some of the specific details that you all went through to get where you are now and some of the future goals that you're hoping to obtain through that network. Are there any other questions that we didn't address during the slides that people want to bring up while we have Megan and Kim? I know you all have a 3 o'clock, so I want to make sure that we're cognizant of your time as well. Any folks on the – sorry, Allison.
So, hi, this is Allison Ryan from Academy Health. I'm sorry if I missed this, and I assume that there's variation, but did you say how long it takes a use case to get all the way around the cycle?
I think it all depends on the what we're after within the use case. I can say, like, the immunization, sending immunization records of how long did you say that would take him?
Well, to be honest with you, I mean, technically, especially when there's kind of national standards, you know, especially with the immunization and the HL7, I mean, technically speaking, it's pretty quick. What tends to slow it down is the policy around it. So from a technical perspective, it's a quick turnaround time. It also helps, and this is what's also kind of brought up in when you have that use case development, if there's any initiative or if there's any state law or any requirements around regulation, then it has a specific date. That helps drive immensely the adoption and the time it takes to get around that use case process. And, of course, it is ever so helpful if there's a lot of funding behind it, because that means there's it's a critical path for someone, and it is obviously an emphasis if they're putting a lot of money behind it.
So, sorry, I don't mean to push on this, but I just really would love, like, a best-case scenario, 3 months, worst-case scenario, 2 years, right? Is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, we've actually, you know, gotten into a pilot. I would have to say we've gotten into certain pilots on some use cases within, you know, a month. It's just finding, and of course we always go into a pilot before we actually send it out to the production. So we, you know, once the use case is developed and the implementation guide is developed, we ask a couple organizations to help pilot so we can further refine that implementation guide. And then once we further refine through that pilot, then it goes into a production phase. And then that production phase, then kind of when it hits that 68% maturity, then it's in, you know, we consider it full production. And it's just kind of maintenance operation onboarding. We've actually kind of turned around an implementation guide and gotten some organizations on board within a mere month, you know, within a month. And so it's just, it's, the timeline really depends on getting people to help pilot that and work on that.
On the opposite side of the spectrum, we've been looking at, you know, an electronic consent management system or consent management in electronic format probably for about 4 years. And that's not for lack of will. It's a lot of legal privacy and other regulatory considerations that are coming into play, and much of it is just varied interpretation of what we can and can't do and kind of understanding that better. So, again, sometimes it's not the technical, it's really the policies behind it and the a lot of the other considerations associated with it. It's certainly not kind of building the Lego pieces.
Thank you.
I think it might be helpful for the board to understand, too, how you went about working with the payers to get them to be committed as partners and be willing to financially contribute.
So this is Kim. I would actually have to give a lot of credit to Michigan Health Information Network, specifically Tim Fletcher, the executive director. He really engaged the payer community, and he acted on that statewide facilitation role. So he, you know, I would have to give him credit for really bringing Blue Cross, which was a major accomplishment, on board to that, and has driven, you know, the adoption rate on certain use cases by bringing that payer on board. And then also just because, you know, the state of Michigan, we had built, you know, helped facilitate building this infrastructure. Once we felt it was ready, that's when we put it into our contract for our Medicaid health plans. So we're just looking for certain policies now to be able to help drive people to this infrastructure because, you know, after we just built it.
I think it really becomes a question of you know, mine and others really helping others to understand what's the value add that the network could provide and how the payers could participate and be an active participant in that, too. So that, to me, was kind of the big piece. And so, yes, Blue Cross was kind of one of the earliest adopters of sorts. They're real strong champions. I note a couple of our Medicaid health plans were also in that bucket, even well before we kind of incorporate some of the HIE pieces into the contract requirements. There were plenty of folks within that space that were already actively engaged in HIE in a strong and big way. So it really, and back to that convener role, has been strong and extremely helpful in kind of messaging this and showing the value.
Excellent. Well, I want to be, again, I know that you all had 3 o'clock, so I want to thank you again. If there are any other questions that we didn't get to today or you walk away and some others come up, please email me and I can filter them over to Megan and Kim and try to address them and see if there's other opportunities to really leverage some of this information. So I just want to thank you, Megan and Kim, again for spending time. I know it's a crazy time right now for you all with your sim launch. So really appreciate taking time out of your busy schedules to talk with us today. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, to try to continue the process of providing some additional information, as I mentioned in the beginning of the meeting, we have a presentation from our data warehousing team. John Subner helps lead that for us here at DHCF. And John, I'll give you the floor to kind of run through. I can be your driver, and you can just let me know. I don't know if you want to stand or how you want to present, but I'll leave that up to your personal preference.
Well, my grandparents always taught me if I'm going to address to a number of people, more than 2 or 3, I should stand. So I'll go by that teaching. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is John Sumner, and I happen to be the lead for our data warehouse project. Began in January of 2014, been chugging along ever since, hoping that we can get to a satisfactory outcome. You know, IT projects are very risky. Quite a large proportion of them tend to fail. We are trying very hard to have a successful data warehouse. But I'll describe in a little bit more detail what we're up to, why we decided to build a data warehouse, where we are. And our data warehouse project is scheduled to go live formally next September, September of 2017. We're going to have a sort of an internal or interim rollout of the applications and features and solutions that we have developed so far this month, at the end of this month. And that would be for internal DHCF staff use. But next September, hopefully, the full data warehouse will be available not only for internal staff, but providers and also beneficiaries. We'll have all kinds of useful information at that one. So if we can go to slide 1. The reason we decided to embark on this data warehouse project is, so most of you are familiar with our MMI system, Medicaid Management Information System. And that's a system that collects claims and process these claims for payment. And that system has served us well when it was established in 2007 until recently, when in terms of the transactional part of the system works fine. We do a great job in paying claims effectively and on a timely basis. But the analytical part of that system, we refer to as Xerox or Oracle Data Mart, we began to experience problems trying to get data out in a timely manner and to have better access to our data. So we were trying to run some data queries, and you'll have to go week by week. And if you're trying to put together a 5-year look at your data, then you're in for a long data pull. So we decided to build a data warehouse based on recent technology, something we refer to as a parallel data warehouse. And if any of you are familiar with that, what it does, it breaks up a query into multiple nodes of computing, and then you can get the result back much faster. So a query that would, under the Oracle Data Mart, that used to take a couple of hours to run, we're hoping we can get that back in less than 5 minutes. So it's like night and day in terms of performance. So the MMI system, as it's currently comprised, we receive claims. These are the business areas: financial, managed care. You know, our MCOs are required to report their payments and claims to us, to the MMI system. And so we have 2 main sets of information in the MMIs, which is fee-for-service claims and MCO encounters. And then we have recipients. Our recipients, once determined eligible, comes into the system, and you're eligible for services, and then we capture all the claims. And we look at things like their outcomes, and we look at make sure that they're receiving the services that they're entitled to. Of course, we have our providers who are part of our system. They submit claims. They have to be Medicaid providers in order to do that. Third-party liability and other reference systems. So the as-is is our MMI system, and we inherited a data mark from Xerox. We refer to it as Cognos. And then we have systems that deal with specific things like fraud and abuse and for general Medicaid management, and a source system which does or deals with accounting and finance. Slide two. So that was the as-is. And this is a little bit more of the, this is in between as-is and to-be. So what we're doing now, instead of just having an MMI system consisting of, instead of just having an MMI system consisting of those business areas that I pointed out earlier, we're expanding the system now so we can ingest additional Medicaid-related data and information. So you see the we're going to build a DHCF web portal. We're going to bring in additional eligibility type information from our DCAS system. We're going to establish a case management system. And recently, CMS has been encouraging states to break up the MMI systems into modular components. And each one of those modular components that we break out, we think would have to rely on the Medicaid data warehouse that we're building while they're transitioning between this current MMI system and the new MMI system. So we'll be able to have some continuity of at least reporting, maybe even some operations, while we make that transition. Under this area that says DC government, we also plan to ingest data from our sister government agencies, like DOH, represented by Dr. Nesbitt, Department of Human Services, Disability Services, Behavioral Health, and others. Other external data sources like CRIS, shown down here, of course CMS as a data source, and we'll also be reporting additional data elements to CMS through this TMSIS arrangement, where they're moving from of course TMSIS or MSIS requires states, every state that's participating in the Medicaid program, to report to them on a monthly basis on a number of data elements. But they're expanding from 450 approximately to over 1,000 additional data elements. And so we will be participating actively in that through our data warehouse and through enhancements to the MMIs. So as part of our data warehouse, we'll be making available business intelligence systems, BI tools like Tableau and Power BI and SAS Visual Analytics. We do have a SAS data store. So I have some very competent and skilled data analysts that work there, but we'll be adding some more tools to other agency staff who are working in programs who should be best able to process and interpret their data. And we're building that kind of capacity. So the future benefits of building the system would be able to, currently we under the Cognos data mark, we only had access to about 4 to 5 rolling years of data. Under the new system, you'll have access to initially about 12 years of data, and then ultimately to about 20 years of data. So you have a much longer time period to do forecasts and all of that good stuff. More robust data sharing with our sister agencies, partners, and external providers. We'll have an enterprise view of the database that will be normalized. We'll have one single source of true data when it comes to reporting. And that data would be in an environment where we would provide easier access for internal DHCF staff and end users, as well as providers and programs and other stakeholders who would need that data. We would do a lot of advanced analytics like risk analysis. What if